From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Gorlot, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. Women played a key role in the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, and they won the right to vote before women in the United States.
There were women of the suffragists in the United States who protested outside the gates of the White House saying, Russia is free and we're not, because the Russians were really ahead of us in that.
We'll hear from historian Rochelle Ruthchild about the women's rights movement in Russia. But first, Rebecca Cruz joins me to discuss this week's elections in the Netherlands and the massive case of food poisoning in Egypt.
This has been one of the biggest calls through all of that, is that the government has to provide for the people. They have to do better for their people. And this is a sure sign that they aren't able to do that.
That's all coming up after news from NPR. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlot. Rebecca Cruz, let's talk about elections in Europe, particularly in the Netherlands. Everybody's been watching what's been going on in Europe and elections as of late, as we see this trend in Europe as well, of movement to the right with parties, far-right parties, that are anti-immigrant, anti-Muslim, anti-EU, have been winning over the past few years. And, of course, Brexit was a big part of that. But in the Netherlands this week, Geert Wilders, it's known as, I think, is the Dutch Donald Trump. Everyone was watching this election, but he didn't actually win as many votes as people had expected. His party didn't win as many votes as people had expected. The right keeps winning seats, but not enough to govern. It seems to be maybe at least a pause on populism in Europe. Tell us about what's going on in the Netherlands.
Yeah, his Freedom Party, they won a couple of seats, but they didn't take over. This is a parliamentary system, and so it has to do with the number of seats and the, as you said, the government that's formed. This was an interesting election. 81% went to the polls. They were lined out the doors. This was the highest turnout in three decades, and in many ways was seen as a referendum on populism on the far right in Europe. There are two more elections coming up this year, two big elections in Germany and in France. So this was kind of viewed as one of the tests to see how things were going to go in the region. So, yes, the Conservative Party, the prime minister that was already in power, has said that this is a victory over populism. What we aren't talking so much about is one of the other parties that didn't fare too well, and that is the Labour Party. They are down 75% since 2012. That's a significant amount. But what's interesting here is that the Dutch finance minister from the Labour Party, Dijsselbloem, he has been in charge of the group of finance ministers from the EU dealing with the Eurozone. He's been a huge proponent of integration, of stricter regulations, and of really trying to rein the Eurozone in to be more effective. And so his likely removal now creates a large vacuum. So while this is seen in many positive terms in terms of the EU and the European integration, from the Eurozone and the economic side, we may not see the consequences yet, and they may be significant.
Well, there has been some discussion about whether we would see other exits like Nexit, the Netherlands exiting the EU. So right now, I guess we can maybe think there's been some brakes put on this movement. But it isn't really a move away from the right. Again, you mentioned how the center-left party, the Labour Party, keeps losing seats. The right just the votes seem to be scattered among the right rather than giving anyone some sort of ability to govern. It's just scattering the votes. But yeah, France and Germany up next, and maybe even Italy. They might be calling for elections in Italy. So we'll see what happens in this part of the world. Well, let's move to Egypt, where this week a terrible story about more than 3,300 children being hospitalized because of food poisoning within an hour of having eaten their lunches at state-run or public schools, basically public schools in an impoverished area of Egypt. There are only a few that remain in the hospital, but this was a horrible outbreak and one in a series of events that have been happening as of late in public schools, some really suggesting that there's the economic issues, political issues in Egypt are leading to a significant amount of neglect to the public-run institutions there.
Yeah, 8 schools affected in this recent outbreak, and as you said, in an impoverished area. So there is a kind of a haves and a have-nots politics going on there, or at least that's a perception. And this is a trend. Earlier this month, there was another situation where over 200 students were affected from food poisoning. And even in 2013, a university in Cairo, there were students that were complaining of food poisoning or stomach issues after eating government-provided food. So this is a large issue, and it does point to neglect, but it also points to the larger issues of how much the government can provide for its citizens. Of course, in 2011, after the Arab Spring, Egypt brings in a new government, and there's been some turmoil there. But this has been one of the biggest calls through all of that, is that the government has to provide for the people. They have to do better for their people. And this is a sure sign that they aren't able to do that, and it's affecting their children, which, of course, makes it very personal.
Well, we'll have to keep watching Egypt, but this is a sad thing to see happening in that part of the world.
Absolutely.
All right, Rebecca, thank you so much for being here, as always.
Thank you.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this discussion or answer any questions you might have. Leave your comments in the Worldview section of KGOU.org, or like us, follow us, and interact with us on Twitter at WorldviewsKGOU and at Suzek Rolat. Next, Rebecca Cruz will talk to historian Rochelle Ruthchild about Women's History Month and women's rights in the Soviet Union and Russia today. I'm Suzek Rolat, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzek Rolat. Historian Rochelle Ruthchild studies the women's movement in Russia and the Soviet Union. She wrote the book Equality and Revolution, Women's Rights in the Russian Empire, 1905 to 1917. She's also a member of the 888 Women's History Project, which recently produced the documentary film Left on Pearl about the 1971 International Women's Day March in Boston. She's currently a resident scholar at Brandeis University. She spoke with my colleague, Rebecca Cruz.
Rochelle Ruthchild, welcome to Worldviews.
Happy to be here.
Well, you are a historian, historian of women's issues. And maybe that's the place to start today, is talking a little bit about the role of women in history. We know, of course, that women have always been in crucial events throughout history, but we haven't heard much about them.
Yes, one of my tasks really is to write women back into the history of Russia, and I'm very much inspired by the work of Joan Wallach Scott, who wrote a book called Gender and the Politics of History, where she talks about how the historical profession has been generally telling a male story, and why it's important to include women and include conceptions of gender in the writing of history, and that how conceptions of history have changed over time. And now, because of the women's movement, really, there's much more awareness of the role of women, that women have played, and also about gender conceptions and how they can shape people's understanding of history.
The role that women have played, both peasant women, women that were in higher rungs of society, all sorts of women. We tend to focus on people in power, and those haven't been women traditionally, but there's so many stories to tell.
That's right. I mean, there are stories of the women who may have been married to the men in power, but there's also stories of the women who were the servants, or the women who were peasants, the women who occupied other class positions. And again, the women's movement has really pushed to make that awareness something that is true for across all the different populations.
Well, and perhaps it's appropriate that we are having this conversation in March. In 2011, President Obama designated March as Women's History Month in the United States. And as you said, you're really focused primarily on the role of women in Russia and the Russian Revolution. A story, I have to be honest, I didn't know all that much about. The women were very crucial at that moment. And in fact, March 8th is International Women's Day, and that's an important date.
Yes, it is. Actually, just to give a little bit of background, International Women's Day started in the United States, and it was a holiday called National Women's Day, which was celebrated in 1909 by the U.S. Socialist Party as a result of strikes in New York City by textile workers. So it actually has its origins in the United States. Then it was adopted by the International Socialist Movement on August 26, 1910, so 10 years before women got the vote in the United States, as a holiday promoting suffrage. It was celebrated in Russia for many years before 1917, but on February 23rd, and the Russian calendar was 13 days different from the Western calendar, so February 23rd was Russia's March 8th. Women went out on the streets for International Women's Day to demonstrate, and that actually sparked the Russian Revolution, which led to the toppling of Tsar Nicholas II.
But we don't hear about this. We haven't heard about this in our history books, and it sounds like in Russian history books this has been erased or had, until recently perhaps, not really been focused on.
That's true. February 23rd, after the Bolsheviks took over, they chose to erase the history of the women's demonstrations, and they created two separate holidays. One was Red Army Day, which is February 23rd, and then International Women's Day, which is March 8th, and the kind of gender distinctions, Red Army Day being a celebration of men primarily, even though over almost a million women served in the Red Army during World War II. Still, it's a male holiday. And then International Women's Day, which has evolved into a holiday that has more to do with candy and flowers than its original intent.
If we go back to the original February 23rd, the spark, as you said, and then there were some protests, as my understanding, afterwards that involved women's suffrage. This was not just a couple of women in the streets. This was a mass protest or protests.
Yes, it was the largest women's demonstration. Between 35 to 40,000 women and men were out on the streets on March 19th, which is a kind of invisible demonstration. Now in history, and one of my goals really is to make that more visible, because as a result of that demonstration, the leaders of the provisional government and the Soviet, who were the governing bodies in the early days after the revolution, agreed to give women the vote. So Russian women actually got the vote in 1917, and Russia was the first major power to give women the vote. U.S. women didn't get the vote until 1920. 3 years later. And in fact, there were women of the suffragists in the United States who protested outside the gates of the White House saying, Russia is free and we're not, because the Russians were really ahead of us in that.
Well, and it's interesting that you note that this day in particular has its origins in the United States, and yet it's a holiday that most people in the United States probably didn't hear about, if they've heard about at all, until relatively recently.
That's right. I mean, as you say, President Obama proclaimed Women's History Month, but International Women's Day itself was proclaimed as an international holiday by the United Nations in 1977. And very often the origins, the socialist origins of the holiday are obscured, and people say it started in 1977. But in fact, there's this whole long history before then of International Women's Day celebrations.
So its association with communism, with socialism, is probably part of the reason that we haven't celebrated it in this country.
Yes. I mean, it's Mother's Day, I think, really has become the big women's holiday in this country, as opposed to what it is. International Women's Day is very often the holiday that's celebrated for women in other parts of the world.
Right.
Not only in the socialist or former socialist areas, but in, I would say, most parts of the world outside the United States.
That's historian Rochelle Ruthchild talking to my colleague Rebecca Cruz. After the break, they'll talk about women's rights in the Soviet Union. I'm Suzette Corlett, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Corlett, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Our guest today is historian Rochelle Ruthchild. Her research focuses on women's rights in Russia. Before the break, she was talking with my colleague Rebecca Cruz about the role women played in the Bolshevik Revolution.
So we have International Women's Day. We have the spark that occurred in Russia in 1917. What was the situation for women after that? If women were so crucial in leading or pushing the revolution, does that mean that they had a large voice after the revolution?
Well, I mean, the Bolsheviks, once they took power, Lenin and his wife Krupskaya and many of the people who surrounded them were actually very interested in liberating women, and they thought that they could do so with a series of declarations and proclamations. So right after the revolution, the Bolsheviks taking power in October, Lenin issued a whole series of proclamations, such as equal pay for equal work, marriage equality, not in the sense that we understand it today, but that either partner, and it was heterosexual marriage at that point, could choose the name of their that they wanted to give to their children, so that, for an example, Leon Trotsky actually chose to have his children named after his wife, take the surname of his wife. They decriminalized homosexuality. They proclaimed maternity leave, very generous maternity leave for women, and a whole series of declarations and laws that the purpose of which was to really move women towards equality with men. But as they soon learned, it's one thing to make proclamations, and it's another thing to actually change behavior. Over the course of the Soviet period, you went through times when the government was very supportive of women's liberation, and there were other times when, particularly under Stalin, they moved back towards more traditional views of the role of women. And for much of the Soviet period, women had a double burden. That is, the notion of liberation was that women would go into the paid workforce. But the other side of it is who's going to take care of the children and who's going to take the care of the making food preparation and other things like that. And women were the primary people who were responsible for that in addition to their paid work. In the last years of the Soviet Union, particularly under Leonid Brezhnev, who actually is the most popular of all 20th century Soviet leaders, there were arguments. It was probably the freest debate that there was in the Soviet Union about what the role of women would be and how to equalize domestic work so that women were not primarily responsible for that. Under Gorbachev, you begin to see a kind of retrenchment, even though Gorbachev and his wife represent a kind of egalitarian relationship in a lot of ways. He began to talk more about women, the importance of women's role in the home, and particularly the importance of women as mothers. And that's partially connected to the demographic crisis that the Soviets were having at that point, where they had a very low birth rate.
So the double burden, the expectations placed on women, the waxing and waning in Russia as well as in Eastern Europe seemed to create a divergence with the Western women's movement, because many of the things that were being fought for in the West, for getting women employed and those sorts of things, those existed under communism. Their labor force participation was quite high. Political participation was not genuine, but it existed. And those were not things that they were fighting for in the Soviet times, but in the United States, that's what the women's movement was focused on.
That's right. Many of the things which we still haven't gotten, such as generous maternity leave, such as really almost encouraging women to move into the labor force, into non-traditional jobs, state policy encouraging that is still something that, at least in our country, is not accepted or the norm. We still haven't passed an equal rights amendment. On the other hand, the Western women's movement was a grassroots movement coming from really consciousness-raising groups and other grassroots phenomena. In the Soviet Union and the socialist bloc countries, women's liberation was something which was state policy, and you could almost say it was kind of imposed from above. Given these structural problems, given the double burden that led many women to be more accepting of this notion of returning to the home, moving away from the paid labor force. And of course, in the immediate post-Soviet period, women were the ones who suffered greatly from the economic crisis that happened and the large unemployment. Women were the ones who were very often the first fired. And when they were to be hired, the ads would say things like women should be without complexes, meaning you would sleep with your boss. That was almost a requirement. So you had a real retrenchment in that period, and you have a real retrenchment to this day.
I was going to say, it's a kind of a post-socialist patriarchy that's really been accentuated and put in place, and we know that in this country and other parts of the world, there was a women's march, the massive women's march in January, one scheduled to take place in Russia, never materialized, and in fact, we know that some questionable legislation was passed that next week.
That's right, one which decriminalized family violence, which was supported, actually advocated by some women legislators in the Duma, the Russian parliament, and supported very strongly by the Russian Orthodox Church, and which said, you know, it's okay to slap your kids around a little bit as part of disciplining them. And that clearly is a move backward, given that the levels of family violence in Russia are quite high, and there is a long tradition, including peasant proverbs, about beating women and beating children, for that matter.
Very, very discouraging on that, and certainly a very complex case, and history certainly plays into that. We only have a couple more minutes, but I do want to focus on a film project that you are involved in called Left on Pearl. If you could maybe just tell us a little bit about this.
Yes, Left on Pearl is a film about the surprise ending of the 1971 International Women's Day March in Boston, where a group of women started the march in Boston, crossed the Charles River Bridge into Cambridge, turned left on Pearl Street, and wound up occupying a Harvard-owned building and demanding a women's center. In the end, the women were triumphant. And the end result was the creation of a community women's center, which we think is the oldest continuously operating women's center in the country and maybe in the world. And in addition to that, because the land on which the building sat was a land that was contested by people in the neighborhood who were protesting Harvard's expansion, it also led to some greater building of affordable housing in the area. But we think of it as a film that shows the connection between social movements at that time in the early 70s, anti-war, affordable housing, women's movement, tenant rights, and how they all came together in some ways in this particular story.
Well, we will definitely watch for that. And obviously, more than 50% of the population, we need to highlight the wonderful work that women do here and around the world. So thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
You've been listening to my colleague Rebecca Cruz's conversation with historian Rochelle Ruthchild. You can find more information online at kgou.org and subscribe to our weekly podcast. Worldviews is produced in partnership between KGOU and the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Katie Holland prepares our research, Sam Dupre produced the show, and Jacob McClellan edited this interview. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Rolat.